goodness, classmates. It is that time again. It is time for another episode of Art Class. Woohoo! This is Lincoln Center's podcast all about art and art education from our Black queer perspectives. And who are we? Why, I'm Rocky Jones. I'm your host as always. I'm here with my two amazing, excellent, wonderful, moisturized co-hosts. Of course, first we have Ia Paige. Hello, Paige Reynolds. How are you?
Howdy.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine.
Oh, good. Good to hear.
I'm doing swell.
Oh, I like swell. What's got you feeling so swell today?
Oh, you know, just being with my wonderful co-hosts. Aww. Getting ready to discuss one of the greatest artists of our time.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, all kinds of reasons to be happy and to be doing swell.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, I'm happy to hear it. Well, and I don't know if you know this, Paige, but we are in the presence of a celebrity.
Oh,
did you know?
I did not.
Yes.
Know. I would have put my face on today.
I know. Should have got my hair did, my nails did. And who is that celebrity in question? Why, it is Dr. Lee Bynum. Hello, Dr. Lee Bynum.
Oh my God.
Can I have your autograph?
Hello. It's so nice to be here with you all.
Aw, that's so wonderful. So you had such an incredible experience. I'm still agog. You were telling us. My mouth is agape. Agape and agog.
Come on, SAT words.
But you were recognized on a plane. That's so crazy to me.
We all know about snakes on a plane. This is about Lee on a plane. It was so surprising. I was sitting beside a perfectly delightful and very well-dressed young man who had all of the trappings of celebrity, and the flight attendant kept trying to figure out who he was, and she was asking him, are you Bad Bunny, like multiple times. He wasn't. And at some point, he encouraged her to ask who I was, since I was the real celebrity, and he laughed, and then I laughed, and she laughed, and then he said my entire government name, Dr. Lee Bynum, exposing the fact that he actually did know who I was, which instantly made it less funny. But after we chatted very briefly, he was not a stalker, and instead just a person who listens to the show and likes Lincoln Center, and it absolutely made my day. So shout to Amir for making my day. Also, shout to the flight attendant who brought me an extra Bloody Mary upon learning that I was a celebrity that she didn't know. And also shout to my cat who is trying to lick the microphone. It has been quite a last few days.
And look at you already getting celebrity perks.
I mean,
that free unmixed Bloody Mary.
Delicious. Absolutely delicious. Well, funny enough, I was not recognized on my Sun Country flight back from Puerto Vallarta, but all right. And that's probably for the best.
It might be. It sounds like there was an aspect of that experience that was at first frightening, maybe. At least.
Yes. And well, judging by some of the photos in my camera roll, there were some frightening things that happened in Puerto Vallarta as well. Anyway. Highly recommended, though. Beautiful town, beautiful beach.
Nice town, beautiful beaches.
Beautiful beaches, beautiful beaches. Well, we have an absolutely jam-packed show for you today. I am so excited. We have the incredible friend of the show, Cao Kalia Yang, for Career Day. Love her so much. She was a guest way back when we were on The Score, one of my favorite episodes that we ever did, talking about her book, The Song Poet, which was turned into an opera at Minnesota Opera, and it was just so such a wonderful conversation. So back here, though, she's back here to talk about what it's like to be a novelist, which is fascinating if any of you all are interested in the ins and outs of becoming a novelist. And then after that, we are joined by scholar and musician Jake Blunt, who is here to talk all about folk and blues and country and all of those amazing things that are quite in the zeitgeist at the moment. Mm-hmm, Black mm-hmm. people playing the banjo and doing folk music. I wonder why that is.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. Anything been happening?
I don't know.
I recall something about the Queen reminding us all that country music started with Black people. I think maybe that has something to do with this moment. She did make a statement about that recently. The Queen, you know.
Interesting. You know. Now, Paige, do you have some sort of mainline to the ancestors, or what is going on? Because with this whole kinfolk idea, this whole kinfolk segment, were you on the phone with Parkwood Entertainment while we were putting the show together, finding out what Act Two is?
Maybe I know one of Beyonce's people. Maybe we share a Wi-Fi or something. I don't know. Okay. Maybe. Because I also predicted the house music era. I predicted that because I said her voice, Beyonce's grown woman voice, would sound excellent over house tracks. That alto range would sound wonderful. And it happened. And then, you know, we planned this season of Kinfolk, focusing on folk music, the banjo. And once again, me and Beyonce, we were right here. We're on the same wavelength. And she decided to remind you all of country music's roots. So, yeah, maybe I have a secret in, but, you know, she has people sign the NDA. So even if I did, I couldn't tell y'all.
Well, what isn't a secret is how well those two tracks, Texas Hold'em and 16 Carriages, are doing. Texas Hold'em got something like 20 million streams in a week, and 16 Carriages got about 10 million, which is, again, completely absurd, unheard of. And I really, really like that her landing number one on the country charts came right on the heels of the remake of the Tracy Chapman song. And I feel like this is a big year for Black women, reminding everybody of their role as innovators of American music from the beginning, right? And I'm really glad that we get to experience it in real time. It's a beautiful thing. Reclamation is lovely.
Yes.
Beautiful. Beautiful. And to watch the huge boosts that other Black country and folk music artists are getting just because Beyonce put out two tracks and some beautiful photos. And now these people are also getting more album sales and shows and going viral on TikTok and Instagram and all of that. It's really beautiful to see. I mean, I've known that country music was Black, thanks to my older sister who taught me guitar when I was a teenager. And she didn't just teach it, but she made it a point to teach us the origins of American pop music. And so she showed us this diagram that traced gospel and folk music and blues and country. It's actually the same diagram that's used in the movie School of Rock, if you remember, when he was teaching the kids about rock music.
Oh, yeah.
And he had this big chart on the board. That chart is actually really good and like pretty accurate. To explain the country music is Black. So I knew that, but I love seeing other people know that. And I'm curious if y'all also like had that knowledge like as kids, or if it's something that you had to realize as adults. Or
no, I think I talk about this a little bit in our conversation with Jake, but when I was a kid, like, my mother is an incredible classical guitarist, like I mean brilliant. And you know, I have taking guitar lessons. I've played the guitar for, you know, quite, well, a couple of decades now, but I will never be as good as she is. She's just amazing. And so when I was growing up, she would play all the time, like when I was, you know, going to bed, and she would sing me songs. And a lot of the songs that she would sing were like folk songs from the 60s and the 50s, like when she was learning how to play and when she was growing up. And she would go and in college, she would, you know, play at protests for the Vietnam War and play outside the White House and all those sorts of things. So she knew a lot of protest songs. And so she would, you know, tell me about sort of the tradition of all of this. And I remember very vividly having a moment when I was in high school where I kind of discovered country music on my own. There was, I don't know if you remember in Virginia, I don't know if this was a thing in Michigan, but there was a cable channel that was like the country jukebox. And like people would call in and put like their the code in for a particular song, and then they would play the video. And so I kind of was like, what is this? And then all these, I got introduced to all of this country music, and I was like, oh, I actually kind of really like this. And even had designs for a second of moving to Nashville and becoming a Black queer country star. I moved to New York instead. No, I think, well, I don't know. Maybe. You never know. You never know. Thank you, Debian. But I think I sort of let those dreams go pretty quickly, because I was just like, oh, I don't know, Black people doing country music. But now I'm just sort of like, dang. Also really amazing, like I said earlier, I was in Mexico. You know, this was the first time that Beyoncé has topped the global streaming chart on Spotify in her career. And literally, we were in a club dancing. They played Texas Hold'em twice, back to back. And nobody...
Back to back?
They played a remix, wow, and then they played the original, and nobody was mad, and the whole club went up twice for Texas Hold'em. Yeah. So this isn't just like an American thing. This is a global phenomenon. Like, people all over the world are hearing this music and feeling it and reacting to it and getting their whole life. And it's just, it's amazing to see. It really is. So I don't know. Maybe it's not too late. Maybe I'll pack up the cat and the husband and move on down to Nashville.
I mean, look, my timeline is currently aglow with gays in silver cowboy hats in every other picture. Your moment is now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. If there was ever a time, this is it.
Give us a few bars right now.
Go tune up your guitar. We'll wait.
You're gonna have to pay for that. That's gonna be on the Patreon.
Right, you're right. We'll save it for the bonus content.
Yes, Patreon. All right, we're being so silly. But we should get to the rest of the show, because y'all don't have all day and class is in session. So we have, as I mentioned earlier, Kalkalia Yang a little bit later. But right now, we are going to have the incredible Jake Blunt.
Yay!
So we will be right back after this.
Welcome back, everybody. Class is back in session, and we have an exciting guest for you here today, a fantastic musician and scholar, Jake Blunt. Welcome to the show. I'm going to read his bio. Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you. Thank you for being here. I'm going to read your bio for the folks, and then we'll jump into it, because we have so many incredible things to talk about just with your musicianship and scholarship. and intersection of identity and Afrofuturism, something we all love here. Let's get into it. Jake Blunt is an award-winning interpreter of Black folk music based in Providence, Rhode Island. Initially recognized for his skill as a string band musician, Blunt has charted an unprecedented Afrofuturist course on his pilgrimage through sound archives and song collections. In his hands, the banjo, fiddle, electric guitar, and synthesizer become ceremonial objects used to channel the insurgent creativity of his forebears. Blunt's performances, like his recent Smithsonian Folkways release, The New Faith, seamlessly merge centuries-old traditional songs with the trappings and techniques of modern Black genres. This genre-queer approach to the traditions has earned his music a place in the very same archives from which he extracts his repertoire. In defiance of genre categories, revisionist histories, and linear time, Blunt fashions an Afrofuturist folklore that disintegrates the boundaries between acoustic and electric, artist and medium, and ancestor and progeny. He has shared his music at South by Southwest, Americana Fest, Carnegie Hall, Library of Congress, NPR's Tiny Desk, just to name a few. He's also earned the Steve Martin Banjo Prize, 2 International Folk Music Awards nominations, 2 first place ribbons from Clifftop already under his belt. But he's also known as a strong advocate for progressive causes within the music industry and appears regularly on conference panels pertaining to social and environmental justice. His writings on music and issues facing the industry have appeared in publications including Rolling Stone, NPR, Paste Magazine, and No Depression. His engagements frequently include lectures and presentations pertaining to his original research and history of Black string band music. He has shared his work at Yale, Berklee College of Music, Smithsonian Institution, and elsewhere. As of fall 2023, Blunt is a PhD student in musicology and ethnomusicology at Brown University. Welcome, Jake. So many accolades.
So many. My God.
And well deserved from what we're all seeing and hearing. I am so excited to get into it. I barely know where to start, but maybe I'll start with one of the most exciting things I saw or came across when I, with your work. I remember watching the music video for Didn't It Rain and already having a love for the song from which it originates. And I felt immediately like seen with you wearing this church hat, singing folk music or in a folk music style, but singing gospel, wearing a harness, queerness like on display, churchiness on display. And I mean, if anyone has heard anything about my background on this show, all of those things are going to resonate. All of those things. I would love it if you could talk to us about what you mean by genre queer as your approach to traditions, as your approach to making music.
I think, so I did not invent that term, candidly. I want to put that out there. I know other artists have been using that for some time. I think what it means to me is, you know, I'm working in these old traditional folk genres for the most part. I haven't put out original music yet. One day we'll get there. But those old songs get split up into different categories a lot. Categories that the more you read and the more you research, you come to realize don't have as much to do maybe with the music itself as the people who were making the music. Back when the commercial recording industry was set up and back when scholars first started paying attention to what Black people were doing. It means that sometimes in order to truly pay respect and inhabit the full breadth of creative experience and creative fuel that our ancestors have made available to us, you have to break down those boundaries sometimes. The only way to liberate yourself in that case is to dissolve these distinctions and conventions that have been visited upon us by these oligarchs of yesteryear's music industry. And I think that's the genre queer process for me, is questioning and breaking down the norms that we've been taught to observe when it comes to music making and to music listening as well.
I have a follow-up to that, and I'm super curious about just how you even happened upon folk music? Is it something that's always been part of your life? And also, how do you see it going into the future? And as I read, you know, I've read a little bit to just prepare for this interview and get to know how you talk about this music. You've especially been talking about preservation and just letting future generations know that this music is not something in the past. It's something that can speak to now. So how are you using it to speak to now?
Yeah, I guess to the first part of the question, my dad grew up on a farm in rural southeastern Virginia. So definitely, you know, there was music culture from that always around. I went to church every Sunday with my grandparents when we went to visit. My dad worked Sundays, so we got off easy at home. But, you know, it was one of those things. It was around my whole childhood growing up, but I didn't know what you would call it or like how you got into it. It was just something that you saw people doing every now and again. And I had this weird chance encounter in high school with this band called Megan Jean and the KFB, who were playing in an Ethiopian restaurant on U Street in downtown DC. And
okay, I saw DC connection.
Yeah, that's what I got.
Got lots of DC connections on this call.
Yes.
Fantastic. Best kind of call to be on. So yeah, I was down there. I was in high school. I saw this band playing and I went up to the banjo player afterward because I saw him playing in this style that I'd never seen before. And Bern Kly is his name. He's still playing with Megan Jean. And he told me, oh, this is the clawhammer banjo style. This is an older style that comes along with the instrument when it came over from Africa, which I kind of went, what? I didn't know anything about that. I've read more and know now, of course, that the banjo was invented in the Caribbean and that there have been finger style ways of playing it for as long as clawhammer has been there. You know, I think we've been attached to maybe one way of doing it, having come from the old place and other ways being new, when in fact, people have been playing it all kinds of way for a long time. But that's sort of how I fell into the version of it that I'm doing now, was meeting him, taking up the banjo eventually in my own time, and then getting connected to the community that's attached to the music, which is incredible, and really my extended family. So I've been lucky to be a part of that. I think part and parcel with that experience of learning this about my own ancestors, the fact that the banjo's first major site of growth in the United States was in the Chesapeake Bay region, which is where my ancestors were held in bondage, right? I found this thing out about what music they might have been making back in the day, and this instrument that was probably kind of at the center of their musical culture that had been hidden from me. And I think part of my role as someone who's working today is like, yes, I have resources available to me that my forebears did not, both in the long-term sense and in the short term, right? I'm attached to an Ivy League institution right now. I have access to so much information that I just did not know was there. I'm still figuring out how much I have access to from being attached to Brown. It's incredible. And as a musician and as a scholar now, I think I'm always thinking about how do I create the archive that I wish I had had when I started out. When Folkways approached me and said, we want you to make an album, I think it would have been a lot easier and maybe more predictable for me to say, okay, I'm going to do another old time string band album. And instead, I sat back and thought, when the next queer Black kid 100 years from now goes and looks back in this archive looking for someone like him, what do I want him to find? And that's where the new faith came from. That's where the Afrofuturist thing came from, was what is the entry that I can make now that I wish someone had made before me? How can I speak to those future listeners in a way that I sometimes wish those ancestors who I've listened to on those old recordings had spoken directly to me.
Oh man, I wish I had something like that when I was a kid. I mean, I grew up in the DMV. And the V specifically. And my mom is an amazing classical guitarist, and she came up in the 60s. And so my lullabies were a lot of folk songs, a lot of protest songs. I sort of naturally kind of followed in her footsteps with the guitar. And in my early 20s, I was writing a lot and performing out a lot and led a rock band, and but I was really drawn to like folk music, bluegrass music, rock and roll music. And a lot of people would come up to me and be like, oh, that's weird. You're Black and queer and you're playing, you know, this folk music. Like, why are you playing this white people music? And I was like, and I didn't have the education that I have now, but I at least knew enough at the time to be like, I don't think that's right.
Yeah.
And so have you come up with that sort of come up against that same sort of resistance? And how do you feel if so, and what do you say?
I don't think I've had to struggle with that as much. And I have the benefit of being kind of the second generation of people reviving this thing. So, you know, we talk about the deep history of this thing, but when I was born in 1995, there were kind of like two Black banjo players out doing the thing and two Black fiddle players. So there was Taj Mahal and Sule Greg Wilson on the banjo and Joe Thompson and Earl White on the fiddle. And this is coming down from, you know, a few years ago, there being hundreds or thousands of people who are partaking in this Black string band tradition. It really almost died out. And then the Carolina Chocolate Drops show up and go down and spend months with Joe Thompson in Mebane, North Carolina. And, you know, to this day, Rhiannon Giddens and Justin Robinson are out just like crushing his tunes everywhere. You know, he's still so present. And I love that. I would not be able to do the thing that I'm doing right now if they had not shown up first and broken the ground for me. And I think within folk music circles, because that band happened, and because especially Rhiannon is still so high profile, also Dom Flemons, because they're still so present in the dialogue, I very rarely run up against that with other folk musicians. I'm sure there are Black people who look at what I'm doing and are like, what's going on right now? I also think oftentimes that the Black people who like seek me out and come to my shows are people who know already. Mm-hmm. So maybe it self-selects a little bit, but part of the task for all of us, I know, that are part of, you know, reviving the Black string band tradition has been, how do we reach out more broadly through programs or institutions or publications that are oriented toward a wider, more mainstream Black audience, just so that people know, like, not everyone's going to become a banjo fan overnight, but so that they know.
So anytime I hear that there is another queer Black person who is putting in time in grad school, I feel like I want to like send a fruit basket or give a hug or something. Especially in the case where I know they're working in an area where there is, you know, gross underrepresentation, and musicology without the ethno is one of the two most underrepresented fields in the humanities. So I'm kind of curious to hear a little bit about what it is to be in a space like that as an artist, and also how doing the research on the one side might be shaping who you are as an artist on the other side.
That's a great question. I think I cannot underscore enough how individualized I think everyone's answer to this would be. Like, if I'd chosen the wrong program, it would be a nightmare. And I'm so acutely aware of that. I'm really lucky to be in a program and in a department that are conscious of the issues that exist in the field, I think, and also view my experience and my current practice as a performer as an asset to my work. Because you do come into the room and go, oh, wow, I think about this in a totally different way than these people who, you know, went and majored in music in undergrad and then went straight to their master's and straight to their PhD. And they have a whole different type of knowledge that I don't have, for sure. But also, you know, you walk into the room and feel a little bit of like, whoa, can I participate right now? And that part has been a little bit intimidating sometimes. But I think I've felt really supported by the other people in my program and by the faculty that I'm working with. I only applied to a few places, and I feel really lucky to have chosen the one that I did, because I think the other ones would have been a bad time, candidly, knowing what I know now. And I never want to be the person who's like, don't go to grad school, don't go to grad. I will say, don't pay to go to grad school, that's for sure. But, you know, be picky. That is my advice to anybody who's thinking about it, only with the limited amount of time that I've put in so far. Be so picky.
Amen to that. And I can say, as a person who feels like they put in a lot of time, be picky. It's just good advice.
I absolutely feel for y'all going through. Listen, the way Rocky just shook his head, can't imagine. But especially with material that is so personal, I'm drawn to the aspect of your work that's like ancestor veneration as well. And, you know, you're dealing with, you know, real people's lives, real, you know, stories of Black innovation and survival. And can you speak to like what it's like to hold that, the responsibility of that also, of, you know, holding those stories, especially so many of them unsung, just not properly acknowledged?
It is sometimes a really heavy load to carry. I take it really seriously, what I do. And part of the reason for going to grad school was feeling like there was, you know, a call from the community of like, you need to put in more work into how you're holding this thing. Because, you know, I have no illusions about the number of academic jobs that exist in the field of ethnomusicology, right? I'm probably not going to be a professor when this is over, statistically. But I think what I can do to make sure that I'm being respectful of those people is to give myself, you know, the best knowledge that I can as far as my research methods and the theoretical base that I'm bringing to the table. All of those things feel really important to me as a way of showing respect.
That also brings me back to talking about the banjo as sacred, as a ritual instrument, as ceremonial. I mean, other instruments too, but could you speak some more to that? How, I mean, historically and just personally for you, it sounds like you have a personal connection with it in that way too.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, historically, we know that it was used alongside different dance practices that sound highly ritualized in the account. And of course, this is one of those areas where maybe the question that we want to ask is precisely the question that nobody would have written down at the time, whether because those enslaved people mm-hmm. didn't want to give everybody their business, or because the person who was writing the account did not think it was worthy of being recorded. My friend Christina Gaddy did some incredible, incredible research into this in her book, Well of Souls, that I highly recommend to anybody who's interested in this aspect of the history. What we know is that during the time and place in which the banjo came about, those dance practices probably would have had some ritual or religious significance, that because of the way dance and song and spirituality were imbricated in the culture at that time, most likely the banjo was used in those contexts. I think that there may be some more concrete stuff than that Christina talks about in her book. But I think for me today, I do think that there's something powerful about playing those super old melodies, particularly when you go back to stuff from like the late 1600s, from like the Hans Sloane manuscript, that kind of thing. You can really go back, reach back into these archives and find something that was being played, you know, 3.5 centuries ago, which is wild to me. And we don't have very much from that time. And I think this is also something that a lot of white folk musicians don't get, or maybe take for granted, that they know so much of their history in Europe, et cetera, going back to the Middle Ages even. And we just don't have that. There's this cutoff point for all of us where we can't figure out where our family came from before, and unless you do your DNA testing. And of course, there's all sorts of problems with the DNA testing for racial identity model as well. So it's a tricky situation. And the banjo, to me, because it started right there in the Caribbean amongst enslaved Africans, and according to Christina and some of the other scholars who've written about it, was one of the very first things that developed here as a specifically African-American broadly, African-American cultural practice, as opposed to something that was brought over the sea. So I consider it to be one of the oldest things that my culture group has to offer me. It's right back at the root of it. And because the songs have changed hands between people the whole time, because each of us is just carrying this thing for a little while that is so old and goes back so far and is going to keep going so far in front of us, I think there's a sense of deep and broad connection both into the past and into the future every time you play, if you're really in touch with it. And sometimes you can't get in touch, but I try to be.
That just is a perfect answer to folks also who say that African Americans don't have a culture of our own.
Yep.
Y'all heard it here. Hello. Yes, we do. It's just that often our connections to that culture as originators gets erased. That's all.
Yes, indeed.
So I have a question for you that's a bit of a follow-up of something that you said a few minutes ago. In musing on whether or not you think you'll end up in the classroom or not after grad school, and I think that's a fair and appropriate thing to question all throughout grad school, because once you're out, it becomes a little bit too late to make that call. I do hope that you will be in front of young people and maybe older than young people who are still learning, because I think that there are so many misconceptions that exist about our place in this work. If there are a couple of takeaways that you might want to have for folks out there who may not understand the relationship between African Americans or Afro-Caribbeans and what we think of as folk music, what might those be?
Oh, man. I mean, I think the thing that goes without saying is our place in the origination of those styles. That would certainly be the starting point to say we were always here and loudly here. And that so often this music has been cast as like music from the British Isles that came over here and just changed a little bit somehow.
When just got a little spicier.
Exactly. Well, and there's like a twofold deception in there. One in the omission of how exactly it changed, right? They never are like, because there were Black people around. Like, you know, they're just like, I don't know, some time passed and stuff happens. And the second half of that, of course, is that it wasn't stuff that was all sourced from one place. It's that many things were brought here and all probably had a more or less equal say. And of course, there was stuff already here before any of that happened. And we have to be so careful when we talk about early folk music in the United States not to do that. This is the first folk music from America thing, as if there wasn't thousands of years of music making that came along before. I think I have a lot more questions than takeaways at this point in my journey. I think if you had asked me this a couple years ago, I would have had some great takeaways, or what I thought at the time were great. And I think if you asked me a couple years from now, maybe I would have more. I think I have a lot of questions about our place in it right now, because as I said, I think I've gotten a pretty positive reception from the folk music apparatus as it exists, right? I don't feel like I've been excluded or marginalized in any way other than the usual systemic ways that are much bigger than what that institution can address on its own. But I wonder at times whether we can make the changes that we require within the confines of the system that we have, and whether the answer is for more Black people to go into folk spaces or Americana spaces or what have you, or if it's for us to do our own thing and then bring that back, right? Do we need our own room to go hang out in, come up with a plan, and then re-enter as a unit rather than trickling in one by one, maybe not being super connected, and then how many people just get like winnowed out because they don't have a support system in place and they go into these super white rooms that feel out of touch and go, I don't know how to talk to these people and there's nobody else here. I wonder all the time about the balance of we belong here and do we need to let go of this for now and find our own space to do something different without other people watching and trying to sell it, which is maybe a bigger issue, actually, now that I think about it.
What do you think the future looks like, could look like for Black folks in folk, or maybe not, maybe it's creating our own space, but in your wildest dreams, what does that future, what's that Afrofuturistic vision for the banjo, for Black string band music as a whole?
I think one of the exciting things that we see now, and this is especially, you know, I've had conversations about this with Rhiannon Giddens, who, you know, I mentioned was kind of one of the people who kickstarted this whole revival that we're seeing now, is that there isn't one obvious direction anymore. You know, when it was the chocolate drops out at the tip of the spear leading the thing, it was clearly this dive back into these old ancestral string band traditions, which is awesome for sure. What I find really interesting now is that for the first time, really, you know, just a couple of years ago before the pandemic, this woman, Dina Jennings, hosts this incredible event called the Afro-Latchen On Time Music Gathering, affectionately referred to as the Thang, on her farm. And Rhiannon stopped by, surprised everybody, like with her Americana award in her tote bag, just drove over from Nashville after the award ceremony and showed up and was like, this is the first time I've come to something like this and not known people. Right? Like, wow. All of a sudden, there are enough numbers that we don't all know each other. We still often know each other, at least through the internet, but we don't all know each other. And people are engaging in totally different ways, right? There are some of us who are playing bluegrass music, some of us who are playing other folk styles, some of us who pick up the instruments and do completely different stuff with them. And what I would like to see even more than just a dive back into the old school folk traditions is reintroduction of those instruments to the other pieces of our music culture that maybe organically, without some of the market forces and sociological and political pressures that drove us away from the banjo and the fiddle, they would have been part of. Like, what would have happened if people had been like playing banjo through the 80s? Like, can you imagine P-Funk with banjos? Like, you know, there's like all this stuff that could have happened. And like, maybe it wasn't ripe for that, right? Like, I'm not saying that would have been the thing. It wouldn't have hit for everybody, probably. But I'm really interested to see how these instruments and these traditions start to emerge in places that people don't obviously connect them to, whether it's Lil Nas X sampling a banjo in Old Town Road, or, you know, it's shown up in a few different really interesting places lately. I'd be interested to see how that progresses and how far people can push it, because I think the need to fossilize Black traditions and say we're doing this very old ancestral thing is kind of a control mechanism that is forced upon us. I actually was just reading a section of Alexander Wahelier's book, Phonographies, where he talks about the idea that Black culture is separated from modernity in all these difficult and complicated ways. And he's really invested in specific technologies, specifically the phonograph in that book, but speaks to it in a way that I think is really powerful and was really impactful for me as someone who is often involved in these ancestral traditions. And then when I do something that doesn't sound like a reenactment, people are shook by it. I think we need to make more space to acknowledge that these traditions have a lot to say to the present day and have a place in the future, and that it doesn't have to be that we're just reenacting an old thing that's been done before with them. Part of continuing and respecting the tradition is allowing it to take new shapes.
Well, with that, I would love to hear more about your music, specifically this most recent project, especially the New Faith through a Smithsonian Folkways. And maybe what are some of those ways that we're hearing these instruments, the banjo especially, presented in ways we haven't heard before, just divorced from this just strictly folk context? What are some of the ways that you're playing with that?
So the New Faith was a pandemic era project, which meant there was a lot of solo experimentation that went on. And it was a really wild learning experience, and I'm happy with how it came out. And the concept of the album is that several hundred years into the future, there's this community of Black people who are the descendants of climate refugees. So climate change has happened, bad things went down, people had to move all around. And I kind of envisioned what that would look like, where people would wind up, and decided, yes, I'm going to put this colony of Black refugees on some island off the coast of New England, where, you know, white people have abandoned the island because of the storms, and they needed a place to shove all the brown refugees who came up there trying to find arable land and shelter. So it made sense historically to me. That was kind of the grounding of it. And the idea was to kind of say, what would their folk music look like, knowing that these are people from the future who've heard everything that I've heard, at least retained in the oral tradition, and also many things that I haven't heard before. and what that wound up looking like. And also because of their circumstances had limited access to technology, right? There might've been like shaky electricity, but I wasn't going to give these like refugee camp people advanced computational technology. That wouldn't have made much sense. So the idea was, we're going to take the folk forms that I'm familiar with, that I've spent time with, and we're going to take arrangement and production practices that are maybe more contemporary that might stick. So when people have to go back to the analog version of everything, right? When we don't have computers anymore and we're having to make it all with our hands and our feet and our bodies and our instruments, what does that sound like? And wound up coming up with this record that kind of combines a bunch of production techniques from the hip hop and industrial rock context, and also brings in banjos, brings in fiddles, brings in banjo ukuleles, and is all old traditional songs that take on a very different meaning because of the new context, even if the lyrics haven't changed. And what I wanted to do there was, because I am a queer Black person who has a really complicated relationship with the Black church because of that, I love the song that came with it. I love many of the functions that it had in the community stretching back, but at the same time, I haven't always felt welcomed. And it was a way for me to articulate the significance of those songs outside of a specifically Christian context that maybe doesn't feel embracing to me. So it let me do that part of the project. And I think being able to combine the banjo, especially with those other production techniques, yielded some interesting fruit. And one of the interesting things that I discovered was I had this idea, I'm going to do this like very new thing that hasn't been done before. I'm going to combine spirituals and the banjo and drums, and it's going to be this like amazing ancestral experience. And then Christina Gatti puts out this book, Well of Souls, 2 years later, that's all about how the banjo used to be played alongside drums in spiritual contexts when it was originally invented. So I tried really hard to do something new and instead wound up inventing something from 400 years ago. Well,
just before we go, where can people find you and all the links and all the events and all that good stuff? We want to make sure that we get that out to the people as well.
Well, thank you. My website is jakeblunt.com, and the live tab has all my shows on it. I am on the usual social media networks, and I am on the usual music distribution platforms.
All right. Well, that sounds awesome. Well, Jake, thank you so much for taking the time out. Everybody, please go check out all of Jake's music. It's fantastic. It's beautiful. And can't say enough wonderful things about it. So thanks so much for being here.
Yay. Thank you. Yay.
Hello, classmates. It's Emile here again to bring you the morning announcements. I am your resident violinist with a passion for arts collaboration, and I'm here to encourage you to go experience live art. The following is a short list of events and experiences that we here at Art Class think are cool and you might want to check out. If you're intrigued by this week's kinfolk conversation around Black folk music, then the next two recommendations are for y'all. If you're in Texas, the Fort Worth African American Roots Music Festival is a great place to surround yourself in the sounds of Black folk music. Though banjo and fiddle are often considered quintessentially American, the extensive Black influence on the art form, from the creation of the instruments to the traditions and the roots of that music and how it influenced dance and culture, are not widely acknowledged. The Fort Worth African American Roots Music Festival aims to change all of that. Featuring performances, educational presentations, and jam sessions that center the role of Blackness in African-American roots music. It is the only major city festival of its kind in the United States. It is Black-led and centered on Black artists reclaiming their place in roots music forms through preservation and innovation. The festival takes place March 16th at Southside Preservation Hall in Fort Worth, Texas. Next, I might not need to say it, but Rhiannon Giddens is on tour. Rhiannon Giddens has made an iconic career out of stretching her brand of folk music with its miles-deep historical roots and contemporary sensibilities into just about every field imaginable. A MacArthur Genius Grant recipient and a 2023 Pulitzer Prize winner, Giddens co-founded the Grammy Award-winning Carolina Chocolate Drops and is now a two-time Grammy Award winner with the 8 additional nominations for her work as a soloist and a collaborator. Her newest album, You're the One, is her 3rd studio album and her 1st of all original songs. She is also featured on the latest release from Beyoncé, Texas Hold'em, in case you needed another reason to stan. Her current tour has her gracing the performance halls of New York, Maryland, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Tennessee, Vancouver, Oregon, Washington, California, Louisiana, Arizona, and Texas, all before the end of April. Having performed with her live, I can attest to the greatness of her talent and her skill, and she is also a stellar human being. Check out her website for all tour dates and cities. Finally, in a nod to our most recent Career Day guest, Cao Kalia Yang, I would like to take a moment to highlight her upcoming book launch. The acclaimed author Cao Kalia Yang will celebrate the release of her new memoir, Where Rivers Part, A Story of My Mother's Life, with a launch party on March 19th. The brand new book is a memoir of her own mother's astonishing life story, and it is told through the tenderness and loving words of her daughter with unvarnished clarity. March 19th at the Parkway Theater in Minneapolis, Minnesota. If you'd like more information on any of the events I've mentioned or highlighted, check out the links in the show notes. I'll be back next time with more cool live art for you to experience. Bye, friends.
And we're back. We have a very, very special guest with us today for art class. Guess, what is your name?
My name is Cao Kalia Yang. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. Where are you located?
I'm in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Oh, one of my favorite cities. And what do you do for a living?
I'm a writer.
Oh, what kinds of things do you write?
I write for both children and adults, so I have picture books. My debut middle grade fiction is coming soon. I write memoirs and anything that I feel passionate about. So pieces for Al Jazeera or other publications.
Beautiful. And how long have you been doing this?
This is the only thing that I've passionately and persistently tried to do. I started on the journey as a 22-year-old, deciding that writing was where my future was headed. Went to get my MFA degree and then became a published author at the age of 27. I'm 43.
Wow. So how did you train for this?
You know, the honest answer is that I trained at the feet of my elders. I'm Hmong and I belong to an oral culture. Growing up, especially for the first 6 years of my life in the refugee camp, where I couldn't go to school and where there were no books or TVs, it was stories that really taught me about the world, the possibilities within it. And so I train at the feet of my elders.
Wow. Is there someone in this line of work whose career you admired, either as a kid or an adult?
You know, I love Louise Erdrich, and I remember being in Mr. English's English class at Harding High School on the east side of St. Paul. We read Love Medicine, and there's a line in there where Erdrich writes, "A young girl cries into a bucket, wipes the church down, the church weeps with her." And I thought language had just exploded. I understood every single unit of meaning, and yet everything had just exploded.
Oh, that's gorgeous. So what does a day in the life of a writer look like?
For this particular writer, rather undisciplined. I have 3 kids, so little ones, which is to say they're my number one priority. You know, my forms have shifted. It's gotten shorter because I think the children interrupt me so often in the process. But it's also such a gift that I can write this way and work this way. My drafts are never pretty, and I'm used to that. I'm comfortable with that. You know, for me, the purpose of art is to present a transparent face of humanity.
So what advice would you give to others who might be interested in doing this kind of work?
Do it. Do it, you know, messily. Do it as you can. I think that is the most important thing. So many writers I know trip themselves up because they're editors in the process. Our job is to create what we know, what we understand, what we're curious about, what we want to explore. You know, everything else comes later. And I say, do a little bit every day if you can. But if you can't, like me, you know, when you have those openings in time, run for it. Run as fast as you can to try to get at the end. I think the biggest challenge for a young author is that they have 1,000 beginnings and no endings. So give yourself that opportunity to take one story from the beginning through to the end. And the more you do it, the better you'll get, the stronger your muscles will become.
What misconceptions do people have about writers?
I love this question. That we read a lot, which is so widely spread, but that is not true. You know, I read a lot of student writing when I'm teaching, but I only go to the books when I'm hungry for them. I think for me, the process of creating is so compelling all the time. And so reading is actually something that I have to go to, you know, only when I'm desperate for some kind of perspective.
I love that. Any downside to being a writer?
Yes, money. It is hard. It is hard to survive in America as an artist, period. And as a writer, to say that the words that come from you are worth money is a hard thing to do. It's a hard place to have to position yourself. So the inconsistent financial challenges, you know, and I'm a 43-year-old writer. I've been doing this all of my career. You know, that remains a challenge.
Yeah, I completely understand. May I ask, do you have any upcoming projects or endeavors that our classmates might want to hear about?
Yes, this year is a 4-book release. Next year is a 3-book release. Wow. So lots of books are coming into the world. And even as they're coming, I'm also challenging myself. So right now I'm working on my first adult fictional project, When We Are Ghosts. When We Are Ghosts, and it's so lovely and freeing and inviting and scary, but I'm all for it.
I can't wait to experience it. Having read and heard your words on many occasions, I am very much looking forward to your moving into adult fiction for this next project. But before I let you go today, I would love to hear if you had a perspective on why writers should not be replaced by artificial intelligence.
You know, everything that comes from me is a surprise to me, Lee. And then whenever I've encountered the writing of, like, you know, artificial intelligence programs, it's very predictable writing. It's very pattern writing, you know, and the work of the artist is to break into the patterns of people's lives. That's what we do. And you can't do that in a predictive program.
Amen to that. This was really fascinating, Kalia. Thank you so much for giving us a little bit of your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so much fun.
Absolutely. And we'll be right back.
Right, and we are back. Thank you for another wonderful career day, Lee, with Cal Kalia Yang.
It was my pleasure. And everybody should make sure they go out and buy Where Rivers Part, A Story of My Mother's Life by Cal Kalia Yang. It is out on March 19th, 2024, everywhere where fine books are sold. And I got an advanced copy and it is absolutely excellent. The language is beautiful. Mm-hmm. It'll make you cry. It'll make you laugh. It's really, really wonderful. So please do check out this and any of Kalia's other wonderful, wonderful books or operas.
Yes, yes. I mean, and she is one of those folks that just like writes the way that she speaks. And she speaks beautifully.
So beautifully. Just,
oh my goodness. If I even had 1/8 of the perspicacity and eloquence that Cal Kalia Yang has, I don't know what I'd be doing. You think I'd have some of those things hosting a podcast.
I mean, here I am thinking, you literally talk to people for a living. Maybe you'd be doing this.
Maybe I could. Yeah. All right. Whatever. Anyway. Leave me alone.
You'd be in Nashville writing country music.
There you go. Hey. There you go. I'm doing my best. I'm doing my best. Hand me my spurs. I'm a horse. Anyhoodle, it is time for our favorite segment. Yes, of course, that is Pure Black Joy, PBJ, a little snack for your soul. This is where we talk about a Black person, place, things, a piece of culture, art, food that's making us happy this week. And funny story, the PBJ this week is actually us. Go figure. So exciting. Last year I was so honored to be asked to be interviewed by Paul Hansen, who has written a book along with a Brett Ashley Crawford PhD called Raising the Curtain: Technology Success Stories from Performing Arts Leaders and Artists. And the book is a really cool sort of collection of stories and anecdotes from people all across the performing arts sector who are using technology to advance their art forms. And Paul wanted to talk to me a little bit about the former iteration of this show called The Score, which hopefully you all know.
Never heard about. Of it.
Sounds familiar.
Right, maybe. Right. Maybe once or twice. Maybe you listened. But it's really, really exciting and just humbling, and you know, just feeling honored that this little show that we created and spent several years working on knocked little behinds off to create, you know, created an impact and is considered a successful endeavor that sits at the intersection of technology and the performing arts and EDI work. And it's just really cool. Like, we're in a book. Like, our picture. Like, the three of us just smiling, just like, hey, you can go to the library and get a picture of us. And some and some nice words about our show. And so just want to thank Paul and Brett for that opportunity. And everybody go out and buy Raising the Curtain wherever fine books are sold. Go get it when you get Kalia's book. Get a double feature. But isn't that cool? Isn't that amazing?
It's cool to know we'll be in a library and things, you know. Mm-hmm. I keep telling people when they ask me about the podcast, I'm like, I forget that stuff like this can happen because you record it and then you put it out into the world. Mm-hmm. And then mm-hmm. it's just there. And you hope that people are listening and that it's impactful. And it's just beautiful to see it come back to us and be, you know, recognize, especially out of a little project we started at the beginning of the pandemic. So, yeah, shout out to us.
From the broom closet to the bookshelf. It is kind of a little bit of a tickle because I write about art and technology and never expected to be the subject of it. And, you know, given that we started this particular show with a conversation around banned books, like it definitely mm-hmm. does feel mm-hmm. Very interesting to land in a book because of the choice to talk about stuff that matters to Black queer people. So I definitely, big old nerd that I am, got such a little kick out of seeing me in a book about something great and productive.
Yeah, it's like it's like about something that I'm like actually like proud of, and it's not like yes. some like terrible scandal with like, you know, my panties around my ankles like I always thought it would be.
It's also that's something nice. To show my family when they're like, what do you do again? What? I don't quite understand. You just talk into a microphone and Now there's something tangible. Yes. So,
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, I think that's going to do it for us, everybody. Just want to thank you all for tuning into this show, Art Class, which we're also very proud of. And maybe you'll see in a book someday. Who knows? But I'll tell you that that won't happen unless you all subscribe and rate and review and leave us 5 stars and tell your friends about how cute and fun we are. And I'm just going to, as a little bit of incentive, just perhaps tease that I know we already have a celebrity hosting the show, but next week, but our next guest is a for real celebrity,
an actual celebrity,
and I could not be more excited about what is going to happen. And I will just perhaps a little hint. I am bouncing with anticipation. That's good, right?
That's a good one. That's a good one.
Thank you. Anyway, so stay tuned. I'm super excited for our next show. It's gonna be really, really fun. And I think that's it. Any words of wisdom before we go?
The bell doesn't dismiss you, I do. Okay, class dismissed.
Thank you so much for checking out Lincoln Center's Art Class. The show is hosted by Lee Bynum, Paige Reynolds, aka Mabole Inawale, and me, Rocky Jones. The show is produced and edited by yours truly. Our artwork is by Patricia Sanchez Navarro, and our music is Dope Skeletons by Frequently Asked Music. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can really help us out by telling all of your people about the show, subscribing on your podcast platform of choice, and yes, leaving us a positive review wherever you're listening, but especially on Apple Podcasts. It's a small act, but it really, really helps us out, and we just might read your review on air. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit the Art Class page at lincolncenter.org, follow all of Lincoln Center's various social media profiles, and feel free to reach out to us anytime at artclasspod@gmail.com. We'll see you next time, and until then, class is dismissed.